When history looks back, it'll look at Ford and GM giving up on electric vehicles 15, 20 years ago. It will look at NASA giving up on going to the moon. So if you say, which individual has done more to move us into the era of electric vehicles or move us into the era of space travel, he probably ranks number one.
That's biographer Walter Isaacson, reflecting on how Elon Musk is a powerful force for change in the world. I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line podcast. Walter Isaacson has written the biographies of some of history's greatest geniuses, Leonardo da Vinci, Benjamin Franklin, and Steve Jobs.
Where I grew up in Louisiana, I had a mentor who told me there are two types of people from here, preachers and storytellers. So for heaven's sake, be a storyteller.
With his latest bestseller, he examines the life and accomplishments of the world's richest man, Elon Musk.
I reinvented electric cars, and I'm sending people to Mars in a rocket ship. Did you think I was also going to be a chill, normal dude?
After spending 2 years at Musk's side, Isaacson paints a complicated picture of a man shaped by a turbulent childhood in South Africa who believes he can save humanity.
So you have this lonely kid sitting there in the corner of bookstores, imagining himself as an epic hero, but also with these demons dancing in his head.
3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition.
That mindset has led Musk to revolutionize electric vehicles and space exploration with Tesla and SpaceX. He also has a new AI startup focused on nothing less than understanding the true nature of the universe and is working on a brain-computer interface, i.e. chips in brains.
He's pushing the bounds. There's something slightly unnerving about that, but also I think we need a little bit of an injection of that in the American psyche today.
But Musk's control of technology also gives him an outsized role on the world stage, including at one point, the ability to decide internet connectivity at a key moment in the war in Ukraine.
No individual should be able to decide on a given night, let me figure out whether we should allow this attack or not.
Plus, there's Musk's controversial Twitter takeover, where he's vowed to restore free speech, then banned his critics, and gone down the rabbit hole of conspiracy theories himself.
He has this ability to be unhinged at times. And it's not a pretty sight, him unhinged.
Walter Isaacson, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you, Margaret. Great to be here.
You spent 2 years shadowing Elon Musk.
Mm-hmm.
In 680 pages, you set out to answer the question, could he have been more chill and still be the one launching us towards Mars and an electric vehicle future? What's your answer to that question now?
You got to take Elon Musk the whole cloth. The absolute intense person is what's getting his rockets launched. It also makes him a very difficult character. But if you had a chill Elon Musk, a restrained Elon Musk, we'd all probably like being around him a bit more sometimes. But I don't think he'd be the one shooting the rockets to Mars or getting us into the electric vehicle future.
You agreed to become Elon's biographer at a high moment for him, before he went on to purchase Twitter and become a more controversial figure.
Yeah.
He had vast success with SpaceX. He had also achieved vast success in the production of Teslas.
Yeah.
As you reflect on the other disruptors in human history that you have chronicled, from Leonardo da Vinci to Benjamin Franklin to Thomas Edison and Albert Einstein, Jennifer Doudna, Steve Jobs, how does Elon Musk stack up?
I think if we look at the current modern era, there are three people who are really changing the way the 21st century will be. First was Steve Jobs, who brought us to the era of friendly computers, smartphones, the app economy, 1,000 songs in our pocket. Jennifer Doudna was able to invent a tool that will edit our genes along with her colleagues. She was able to invent CRISPR, which means we can change our genetic makeup, design our children. Huge. And Elon Musk is the one bringing us into the era of electric vehicles, renewed space travel, a new form of internet in low Earth orbit, and artificial intelligence that's not just chatbots, but self-driving cars and robots.
So where does he stack up?
I think he will be one of the three or four most consequential people of our day and generation, especially as he tries to conquer real world AI, such as robots and self-driving cars. I think in terms of innovators throughout history, his unique contribution is not just being innovative, but understanding manufacturing. I know that seems a little bit less exciting maybe than the creation of the product, but he's able to manufacture things at scale and bring manufacturing back to the U.S.
When you described Jobs's unique ability to create a reality distortion field,
right,
to just drive people towards an impossible conclusion that he demanded was possible, how does Elon's focus and drive and vision compare?
They're very similar in that they both drove people crazy. They drove them to distraction, but they drove people to do things that they thought were impossible, whether it's the reality distortion field, as Steve Jobs' colleagues called it, or Musk, who has an urgent intensity to him. And so if you look at Boeing, Boeing got a contract to send astronauts to the space station and cargo around the same time as SpaceX. They haven't done a test flight yet. But when I walked around the launch pads, like in South Texas for Starbase, and it'd be Friday night at 10 p.m. and people weren't working that hard, he'd demand a surge and people work all weekend. He'd fly 100 people in, just because he felt that the fierce intensity was necessary to push us forward.
Do you admire him?
I do think that we've been a nation that always took some risks, always did some great innovations. Whether you came here on the Mayflower or you came across the Rio Grande, it was risk-taking to be an American. Now we've become a country that's filled with more referees than risk takers, more regulators than people who are innovators, more people saying, oh, you probably ought to not try that. So what I admire of him is he's pushing the bounds. He's questioning every rule, questioning every regulation. There's something slightly unnerving about that, but also I think we need a little bit of an injection of that in the American psyche today.
You place Elon, the man, in the context of his childhood. And you bring his background to the forefront. He had a challenging childhood in South Africa, a father who was certainly emotionally and verbally abusive, summer camps that were full of bullying and incredibly harsh environment socially, and growing up also with Asperger's. How do you think about how all of these elements fuse together to propel his drive as an adult?
It's so interesting to look at him as a kid, socially awkward, beaten up all the time, and one day gets beaten up in the playground of his school and has to go to the hospital. His face is so disfigured. But those scars were minor compared to the psychological scars that came from his father, who made him stand in front of him after that beating. And the father berated Elon, said it was his fault, took the side of the guy who beat him up. And so you have this lonely kid sitting there in the corner of bookstores reading science fiction and comic books and imagining himself as an epic hero, but also with these demons dancing in his head. We all got probably some demons. I had a pretty nice childhood in New Orleans, but we all have a few demons. The question is, can you harness those demons, or do those demons kind of haunt you the rest of your life? And I show in Elon's case, it's both.
You mentioned frequently his fascination with science fiction as a child, but also as an adult.
Yeah.
And the classic book, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. How did that narrative shape Musk's perception of the world?
He felt that there was this great adventure that we had to do. And Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is both very funny, is politically complex, sort of populist in some ways, socialist in some ways, but also grand in epic quests. And he kind of felt we had to figure out human consciousness. Was it unique in the universe? And to what extent the universe represented a question that we had to answer. Why is the universe there?
In just a few years, Musk went from being kicked out of PayPal to creating SpaceX.
Right.
This company introduced reusable rockets, sent astronauts to the International Space Station, and has pioneered a commercial space sector. Do you expect, when it's all said and done, he will see fulfilled his vision to have Mars colonized?
Yes, I think at some point. He's very good at turning the impossible into the just very late. So it's not going to be as fast as he wants. It'll probably be 20 years. But one of the amazing things of being at all of his meetings is that amongst all the turmoil sometimes of, you know, Tesla and SpaceX, there was a meeting each week called Mars Colonizer. And he would always try to do that meeting. And it was about, what are we going to wear when we get to Mars? How are we going to self-govern? What will the robots? And I'm going, wait a minute. These people are seriously sitting around talking about what we're supposed to wear when we get to Mars? But it's that sense of focusing on the far horizon that I think keeps him mission-driven.
But explain this, the reason to colonize Mars and the reason to get there.
I think he had three reasons when he decided he was going to make a mission of going to Mars. One was this notion that human consciousness is a very fragile thing in the universe and that it could be snuffed out. Asteroids could hit us. Civilization could decline. Why is it we've never met intelligent life from other places? Well, maybe they got wiped out before they could become multiplanetary. Therefore, he says, humans have to be multiplanetary. And also, it was just a sense of adventure. This is a kid who loves sci-fi, and he's wondering, wait a minute, we went to the moon and then we quit having adventures. What's that all about?
In 1973, William F. Buckley Jr. on the original firing line hosted Alan Shepard, who was the first American in space and the fifth American to walk on the moon for the Apollo 14 mission. Listen to how they discussed space exploration.
Now, what I'm asking you really is there a nexus between the spirit of individual adventure and the resources of the state? You did need Ferdinand and Isabella, or so it was generally assumed during the 15th century, in order to finance that particular expedition. Is it your notion, or is it your idea, that the great adventures of this kind in the 20th century have got to be socialized adventures rather than individual ones?
Oh, I really think so. When one assumes what the total cost of these things are going to be, but I think as long as you're talking in terms of something which is pushing the boundaries of the limits of men and machine, then I think that you're probably going to have to use
the resources,
large
of the state.
Funds, and the resources of the state and government to do it.
Yeah. Is that crazy?
It's amazing to see that. But here's an interesting thing of how it relates to Musk. At that point, NASA was building all the rockets. They give cost-plus contracts to things like Boeing or Northrop Grumman, which means that those contractors would spend whatever it takes and they were guaranteed a profit. What happens is NASA loses that ability, really, to be innovative, I think.
Yeah.
But it makes these fixed-price contracts with SpaceX, saying, we're not going to give you cost-plus. We're just going to say, if you can get it to the space station, we will pay you this much. And Musk is able to do it at about one-tenth the cost of what NASA was doing.
What's remarkable to me about Buckley and Shepard talking there is that I think Buckley would be beyond delighted and surprised that the cost of the space program didn't have to be socialized by the government. That, in fact, that the space innovation is being driven by an individual in the private sector, not the other way around.
You know, without debating William F. Buckley from afar, it's always a bit more complex. There is a public-private partnerships where you have to have some government missions and some government funding, but it's really great to have private contractors take some of the risk as well. And I think it was President Obama who decided, no, we're not going to just make it NASA only. We're going to have these private contractors get fixed cost contracts. And that's a partnership that might work.
But because the government had stopped innovating and individuals were doing the innovating, right?
I do think that government and some of the big government contractors got sort of the hardening of the arteries. They were unable, and Boeing has still been unable, even though it got a contract with for a NASA rocket. It still hasn't even launched a test flight to the space station that's worked.
Well, to your point, you write about what General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said about Elon Musk. He said, Elon Musk symbolizes the combination of the civil and military cooperation and teamwork that makes the United States the most powerful country in space.
And that's it. There is a civil-military cooperation, a private sector government cooperation, and that includes Tesla. It includes electric vehicles. It includes space travel. So these things can't be all government. It gets a bit sclerotic when that happens. And it can't be just the private sector. And sometimes in this day and age, we're not very good at saying, okay, there's going to be a blend.
Well, the blend happened because of the innovation of an individual.
Absolutely. I think Elon Musk has done something with SpaceX that no country and no company has been able to do, which is to launch a rocket and send things into orbit and then have the rocket land and be reused. And he's done it dozens of times in the past 2 years. China hasn't done it. Russia hasn't done it. U.S. hasn't done it. Boeing hasn't done it. And I think that's the key to the commercial and adventuresome space travel we want.
There can be a downside if there's an individual who has so much power that a private and disinterested citizen could have outsized influence, perhaps in a geopolitical conflict, as Elon has been reported to have and as your book has chronicled. In some cases, there is a much-discussed passage in the book that involves Ukraine's request to utilize SpaceX Starlink satellites to enable a Ukrainian drone attack against the Russian fleet.
So that night, he has to decide whether to allow the drone attack by the submarines to work against the Russian fleet in Crimea. It had been geofenced. Ukraine didn't know that. And they're begging him. They're saying, wait, this thing isn't working. Can you turn it on? And he decides no. He fears it would lead to a nuclear retaliation, maybe. And so as I was talking to him, I just asked questions. I said, have you talked to General Mark Milley? Have you talked to the U.S. government? And indeed he did. And eventually he gives up control of some of the Starlinks. He creates this new thing called Starshield, which is a military version. He sells it to the U.S. government, and now the government gets to decide. So I think that's a good resolution.
That's probably where we should have been in the first place.
Right. It would have been good if the U.S. government satellites had worked, if the Viasat satellites had worked. His was the only one that worked.
Do you think the U.S. government was aware that perhaps his technology and his hardware had superior capabilities to the government products that were in competition? They knew that his was superior. So what should the U.S. government have done to prevent that from happening?
Well, first of all, the U.S. government and other companies should be able to make satellites that can withstand a Russian hack. But SpaceX has sent up almost 5,000 of these satellites because he's got these reusable rockets. It would be great if NASA could do that, if Amazon could do that, if other nations could do that.
But what should the U.S. government have done to prevent the circumstance in which a private U.S. citizen had the ability to make such consequential decisions in a geopolitical conflict?
One thing that Musk has said publicly, and he's been very good at not talking about classified conversations, but he said, if the government had made a request for me to allow it, I would, of course, have followed the government's request.
So is it your conclusion that the government dropped the ball?
I think that the government made its own decisions about what was right and finally decided to contract with SpaceX to provide the government with those services. So now the government is in control of these satellites or some of them.
Do you think the government made an improper conclusion about the capabilities of their satellites and communications abilities versus Musk's?
Well, when the Russians invaded Ukraine, and that's months before any sneak attacks were being planned, every satellite gets knocked out. Viasat, government satellites. The Ukrainians have no way to communicate with their troops. There's only one satellite communication system that works, and that's SpaceX, Elon Musk. And so you send them, you see them sending text messages saying, can you help us? And he rushes 100, then 1,000 Starlinks, donates them to Ukraine, which allows Ukraine to withstand the attack. Would it have been good if U.S. satellites from the government had been able to do it? Of course, and that's why we need more innovation.
Or should the U.S. government have purchased them from Elon and then donated them to Ukraine, rather than having a private citizen be the supplier of a government's autonomy?
Yes, and I think that's the way it should have worked. And in the beginning, they were all donated by SpaceX to Ukraine. Then there were private consortiums, and the Europeans paid for some to go to Ukraine. And now you have the U.S. government buying some for its own use in Ukraine. It's taken a while. Should that have happened on the first week? Maybe so, but it took a while.
I mean, the reason I ask, Walter, is because it gets a private citizen in the middle of a geopolitical conflict, and then it makes them the target of many factors. And there is, there was a tweet that Elon Musk tweeted, a quote-unquote peace plan. That was a proposal that reflected the Russian priorities very, very directly, which Ian Bremmer later said came after a conversation that he had had with the Kremlin. Do you know about whether he was talking to the Kremlin?
He talked to the Russian ambassador, he told me, and he knew what the Russian red lines were. He knew that it was Russian doctrine, or so he thought, I'm not an expert on Russian doctrine, that an attack like that on the Russian fleet would be a red line that would justify, maybe not cause, a tactical nuclear response. But the real question is, why should Elon Musk be figuring all these things out? It should have been the government who had control over these.
Which is, right. That's where I'm going with it.
At one point, Musk figures out, man, I shouldn't be in the middle of this war. And he says to me, we created Starlink so people could watch Netflix and chill and play video games. Why am I in this war? And so you see this evolution where he finally becomes a contractor so the U.S. government can take control of these things. And it took a while, but you're right. No individual should be able to decide on a given night, let me figure out whether we should allow this attack or not. It's probably best done by the government, and that's why he's now selling these to the U.S. government, and the U.S. government gets to decide.
I'm just wondering where the individuals at the Pentagon were that were realizing that they should have had control of this way earlier.
Yeah, the Pentagon has bought and contracted with Starlink and, by the way, with a lot of SpaceX entities to get its own communication satellites into orbit. It has really good high intelligence satellites, some of which have to be in high Earth orbit, and they're big. There's only one entity, not NASA, not Boeing, that can get them into that orbit, and that's the Falcon Heavy of SpaceX.
What does the Pentagon say about why they didn't have a relationship with Musk's entities earlier?
General Milley had a very good relationship with Elon Musk. Way before the war, at the beginning, they talked a lot. So I would not assume that there was no relationship. I think there was a lot of things happening back channels, and Musk and General Milley did a lot of talking.
Look, I understand much of this material is classified.
Right.
And certainly much of it can't be disclosed in an open source circumstance. Mm. But is it your understanding that General Milley and the Pentagon were in open communications with Musk very early on?
There's one thing that Musk did not allow me to do, which is to sit in, of course, on classified meetings. However, it is very clear, and it's true, that all the way through, he's had a good relationship with General Mark Milley. They've been talking all along, before the invasion, during the invasion, and after the invasion.
Does Musk have security clearances?
Musk has security clearances.
Let's go to Tesla. The UAW is on strike right now in Detroit. Tesla is capitalizing on the United Auto Workers strike by bringing attention to the differences between itself and the big three. Talk about the contrast between how things work at Tesla.
The UAW strike is about something much larger than even the wage differential. It's about moving to the era of electric vehicles. And those vehicles take at least 40% less or even 50% less time to be assembled, fewer workers. And this is going to be very disruptive moving to that. Musk has a fierce intensity. The notion of wanting to work fewer than 40 hours a week, he thinks people should want to work 60, 80 hours a week like he does. Now, that may be nuts, but he pushes his Tesla workers. And the danger for Musk is, of course, if this strike is successful, there'll be unionization drives again at Tesla plants. So this is something he's resisting.
How much has he fought back moves to unionize at Tesla?
He fought against the unionization drive, and the vote failed for the factory in California. He got dinged, too, for some unfair labor practices involving a tweet, he said, in which he said, our workers get stock options, and that's where they're going to make their money. And if you get a unionized plant, the unions do not allow some of the pay to be through stock options. And that was considered unfair interference in an election, and he shouldn't have done that.
You describe grueling hours and marathon sessions where Musk would walk the line inspecting slowdowns and demanding solutions. And Musk responded to your description of the floor at the Tesla factory by saying that they have a great vibe and that perhaps you spent more time in meetings than you did on the floor in the Tesla factories. Your response?
Well, I certainly walked the factory floors a whole lot with him, late at night, during the day. And he always walked to the red. There'd be a flashing red light showing something was going wrong. So he was intense at that. And he feels that, oh, there's this wonderful vibe. Everybody's playing music. But also, I don't think he sometimes understands some of the discontent, because he does drive people and expects that fierce urgency that he has, that every worker on the line should feel that as well.
One of the things he hasn't been able to deliver on is his promise for autonomous vehicles. Why does he have trouble being honest about the timeline?
I think he even deceives himself about timelines. He feels if he just pushes and says something's going to be done in 2 years or in a year, that'll be a forcing function. One of the interesting things he's done in the past year, which I describe at the end of the book, is he's made a shift on autonomous vehicles, and he wants it to be self-learning, the way ChatGPT can learn by reading millions of documents to give you a chatbot answer. He's making self-driving cars that have computers that are trained by watching billions of frames of human drivers from the Tesla cameras. So this is going to be a forcing function. He always says in a year or two, we will have self-driving. I think it'll take another few years, but I think he's going to be able to get to it through this machine learning, human imitation process.
And I want to get to his investments in AI, but on the question of autonomous vehicles, you actually describe a scenario or a situation whereby he is promising a timeline that he knows he's not going to meet. So it seems to me that in your account of him, this is one area where there was a bit of dishonesty on his part that he was aware of.
I think in 2019, he declares what's called Autonomy Day, and he says, we're going to show a car that can drive from some distance away to the Tesla plant and show it can drive itself. I think he actually believed he was going to be able to achieve that, even though it's crazy. And they almost do. They do have a pretty good demonstration. And it is a forcing function.
But he also knows it's not totally accurate. Like the vehicle isn't really going to be able to drive autonomously.
I think he thought that they might be able to pull it off.
So you think he's lying to himself?
I think
there's a degree of aspiration.
I think that he sometimes mistakes, aspirations for realities. There was never any investigations about misleading or fraud or misleading investors and things. It was almost as if he was in on the joke. Occasionally he'd get up and say, we're going to do it again. We're going to do it by next year. And people would laugh and he'd say, yeah, I know you've heard it before, but someday it's going to be true.
In the case of space and in the case of EVs, the legacy burdens at NASA and the legacy burdens amongst U.S. automakers have given way to a private citizen out innovating them and out producing them. What is one to make of that?
You know, the innovation that Musk has been able to force starts at the most granular level. He looks at a way that there's a valve to make the rocket fuels merge, and it costs thousands of dollars because of government regulations and the way Boeing does it on a cost-plus contract. And somebody on his team realizes, you could take something from a car wash and we could just adapt it. Or we could take a latch that's on a bathroom stall and adapt that. So he's able to bring the cost down by 90% at least on each and every one of these components. And that's, it may not be as sexy as inventing the light bulb, but that's where his innovation occurs.
Elon Musk purports to be a defender of free speech. And you describe in your book how living up to that principle has turned out to be far more nuanced and complicated than perhaps he anticipated.
Right.
You point out his evidence of hypocrisy and his arbitrarily banning his critics. How do you understand the reports that he even throttled reports on the New York Times about healthcare costs shared by President Obama that reached fewer than a million users? Like, are you aware of places where he would throttle content?
No, I don't think he personally said, hey, let's change the algorithm so New York Times story on this doesn't get as much play. But there's a larger issue that you've asked about, which is he says more free speech is better. We want more free speech. And the question, even when we were standing there talking about it a year ago, even his more libertarian friends would say, yeah, but there's a difference between allowing some of this speech and then amplifying it. So you maybe have to be more careful that hate speech or misinformation should not be amplified. And so I think it's much more complex than Musk thought. And he's kind of feeling his way, but he doesn't have a great feel for some of these emotional side
issues.
Well,
this is from your book, you write, quote, Musk had an intuitive feel for engineering issues, but his neural nets have trouble when dealing with human feelings, which made his Twitter purchase such a problem. He thought it was a technology company, when in fact it was an advertising medium based on human emotions and relationships.
Absolutely.
Has he learned anything?
One thing he learned is right in April of this year, when he's launching Starship, it gets up for 3 minutes, then blows up. Typical Elon Musk, an amazing accomplishment and rubble in the wake. And then he meets Linda Yaccarino at an ad sales conference the next day and realizes she's got all the emotional skills and advertising skills he lacks and hires her, never met her before, but hires her within 3 weeks.
Is he going to redirect his focus back to the things he has an intuitive feeling for? Yeah.
He focuses serially on things. Even the night that the Twitter board accepted his offer, it was astonishing. He goes down to the southern tip of Texas and to a meeting with the Starship people to try to figure out a methane leak problem. And everybody's saying, wait, you just bought Twitter, you know. But so he can focus on many things. I think, and you see him talking about it at the end of the book, his focus now will turn to artificial intelligence, to the Optimus, the robot, to trying to get self-driving, eventually to work. And there'll be less of a focus on the platform known as X now.
I want to get to AI, but I just, on the human story or on the human component of this, especially related to Twitter, you tell the story of Yoel Roth, who is a former head of safety and trust at Twitter, who had to sell his house because Musk baselessly linked him to pedophilia. he recently published an essay in the New York Times warning that the harassment that he endured is part of a broader trend with Musk and with social media in general. And he wrote, quote, "Mr. Musk's actions have normalized and popularized vigilante accountability and made ordinary employees of his company even greater targets." Do you think Musk grasps the consequences of his behavior?
No, and I think he should. And I think it's true, as Yoel Roth, who's a really good person, said about social media in general, and frankly, about our age in general, which is there's a censorious pack mentality of let's go online and people get devastated. And people don't realize the consequences of that, whether it's Elon Musk doing certain postings that inflame his followers, or just social media in general. I mean, it's, I think, quite poisonous at times. And people get attacked. They get not just canceled, but, you know, their lives get threatened. That's a deep problem across all of social media. And I don't think Musk has a good feel for those dangers.
Anti-Semitism on X has surged since Musk took over, and previously banned far-right figures have been allowed to return. He's repeatedly denied reports of hate speech rising on the platform, and he even threatened to sue researchers who documented it. He's publicly lashed out at the Anti-Defamation League. He falsely accused the Jewish Human Rights Group of driving down ad revenue. I know you don't believe that he's an anti-Semite, but how do you explain his behavior related to blaming the ADL? How do you understand that?
I think the reason advertising went way down, 40% or more, is not the ADL, which called for a pause for a while, or not these other groups that did it. It's because it's become an environment at times that any normal advertiser trying to get brand awareness doesn't want to be in this toxic stew. So I think it's wrong to blame it on the ADL. He's wrong to do that.
Why does he do it?
Why does he blame it? He blamed it for a while on anybody who was advocating a boycott of Twitter. As you read in the book, early on, people are saying boycott Twitter because they've allowed Donald Trump back or they've allowed some far-right person back. And he wants to actually ban some of these people from Twitter who are calling for a boycott, which is obviously hypocritical if you believe in free speech. You should be able to call for a boycott, as the ADL called for a pause at one point.
So you don't think he thinks more deeply about the consequences of anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish rhetoric escalating on his... I mean, when he blames the ADL... Is he thin-skinned and taking it personally, or is he thinking about the impact of the rhetoric on his platform and the consequences of heightening anti-Semitism?
I think there's a sort of a hypocrisy in his belief in free speech when it comes to the fact that anybody who was calling for a boycott or calling for a pause of advertising, he thought they were trying to destroy Twitter. This inflamed him, and there were many groups, including the ADL, but including individuals, including reporters. And I think that that's wrong. If you believe in free speech, you ought not attack people. Well, you can attack them, but you ought not ban people who are calling for a boycott. And in the end, he doesn't ban it. He doesn't ban in the ADL, but he just expresses his strong frustration.
He sat down with Bibi Netanyahu last week. They sat down on camera. He pronounced that he was not anti-Semitic. He denounced anti-Semitism publicly. I mean, does that kind of an interaction make an impact on him personally?
I think he seems to like Prime Minister Netanyahu. They have a certain bond there. And I think that interaction did have an impact on him, yes.
Do you think he'll be able to turn Twitter into a company that, like his others, have ups and downs, but ultimately are successes?
Well, I think what you've seen is he's made it a less friendly environment for advertising, which is really going to hurt his revenue. On the other hand, he's added features pretty fast. the ability to post videos, the ability to have subscribers, the ability to pay for content. And so I think he will shift it from being mainly an advertising medium, which he doesn't have a good feel for, to being a place where people post content, where people get paid, and it's going to be more contentious. Will it survive financially? I think it will, but it will not be as successful as it would have been had he also kept that good environment for advertisers.
You dedicate a full chapter in your book to Tesla's relationship with China and its opening a factory in Shanghai. China ultimately changed its longstanding policy with Tesla by agreeing not to have a joint venture in the production of Teslas. Why do you think that Xi Jinping made an exception for Tesla that it hadn't in any other case?
You know, I thought there'd be no way that China would change its rules and allow an auto manufacturing facility, especially a high-tech one, to be done without it being a joint venture. And Musk said, I'm not going to do a joint venture. And over he went there. And I think Xi Jinping or the leaders in China thought, well, it'll be better to have the manufacturing plant here. And they changed the rules for him.
40% of Tesla's battery supply chain comes from China. Mm-hmm. You describe Musk as a foreign policy realist. Mm-hmm. How does he think about the role he may be playing in terms of deepening U.S. ties to China?
Well, first of all, he's trying, like many other companies, to not be so dependent on China, not be so dependent on Taiwan, building new battery factories in the U.S., building his own microchips in the U.S. So he's less dependent on those supplies. And that's something that's been true for 20 years at Tesla. It used to have a far-flung supply chain. And Musk believes you should build your own battery cells. You should build your own chips. You should build your own chassis. Have your factories here. So I think he wants to become less dependent. He's going to build a new factory in Austin, but also one in Mexico.
So does he, I mean, do you think he's aware, as an individual citizen who's been on the cutting edge of these new technologies, but also as somebody who's now playing in geopolitics, mm-hmm. does he have a role as an American patriot to think about deepening ties to China?
I think he feels deeply patriotic, and he cares about innovation and growth in the United States. And like many business leaders, he kind of feels that we have to balance confronting and competing with China, mm-hmm. but also finding areas of cooperation. He has said that we've become a little bit too provocative and confrontational with China, and he thinks, as do, you know, Tim Cook or Bob Iger and others, that a more workable relationship makes sense.
For the bottom line, for sure. Mm-hmm. He criticizes the U.S. government's wokeness in instances of censorship. And he chooses not to criticize China for its mm-hmm. censorship. He's, you know, said there are two sides to the Uyghur problem, mm-hmm. A problem which the U.S. Mm-hmm. government characterizes as a genocide. Mm-hmm. How do you explain someone who can advocate against censorship in our country, but is far less vocal about China's approach to its citizens and their freedoms?
I think it's partly business related. He's got a big factory there. He sells there. And he told Barry Weiss, I have a scene in the book. Barry Weiss, who is somebody who was publicizing what it was called the Twitter files. And he says, yeah, I've got business interests there. So I report that.
So he's not a human rights advocate writ large. It's like sort of the most generous conclusion I can draw from that.
Yeah, I don't think that he is a human rights advocate writ large.
Yeah, I mean, the Chinese government that he's working with is promulgating mm-hmm. what we call a genocide. Mm-hmm. So there aren't two sides.
Yeah, and
of that.
I mean, and our government has mixed relationships with China, and so do most businesses.
Yeah, but he hasn't thought deeply about it, is what it seems to me is the case. You describe how Musk is somebody who continually and increasingly gets drawn into, quote, the rabbit holes of conspiracy theories. In recent months, Musk has claimed that Jewish billionaire George Soros hates humanity. He's promoted conspiracy theories that blame the cardiac arrest suffered by LeBron James's son on COVID-19 vaccines. And he called for the arrest of the governor of New Mexico over a public health order that temporarily banned carrying firearms in one county. How is it that the world's richest man and a figure who is on the leading edge of renewable energy and of artificial intelligence and of space exploration so often appears susceptible to the most outlandish conspiracy theories?
Yeah, I think it's problematic. And I write about it, and even his father is that way. His father is sending me some of these conspiracy or fringe theories. And even though Elon doesn't speak to his father, May Musk, his mother, said, the danger for Elon is he becomes his father. So there are times when Musk is perfectly moderate in his politics, and then sometimes late at night, he's retweeting some fringe theory that is
How do you understand
troublesome.
That, though? Like, how do you understand
that? That's what
the
book is about. It's the demons of childhood. It's a guy who sometimes embraces even fringe conspiracy theories, and I try to show it. I try to show all these things you've just described, all the things he's done, the tweets that go back to the calling somebody in 2018 a cave diver, a pedophile, to today. He has this ability to be unhinged at times. And it's not a pretty sight, him unhinged. And then comes the deeper question, which is it part of a whole cloth where a hinged Musk, a restrained Musk, would still be the same person who could get the rockets into orbit? And so you have to say, I don't excuse the unhinged behavior, but I understand the fabric that it's part of.
I totally get that. And I'm not asking for absolution, one because of the other. I've heard many of the interviews that you've done do that. I'm just trying to understand, how does somebody who is so bright in some ways not think clearly about things that are so obviously conspiracies?
Well, he would argue, I wouldn't, but he would, that it was Twitter and the U.S. government that said, you shouldn't question lockdowns, that that's a conspiracy theory, that it doesn't work, or that it's a conspiracy to say mask mandates are a bad idea, or to suppress the Barrington Declaration, or to say it might have been a lab leak from China. To me, these are all open questions. But for him, it was, hey, we've suppressed free speech and maybe tamped down some things that we should have discussed.
So
like
it's a contrarian nature.
He's a contrarian. I'm not trying to apologize. I mean, look, I'm pretty conventional.
I don't think you're apologizing. I'm asking for you to help us understand it. So you think the flirtation with conspiracy theories actually comes from the same place that his contrarian questioning of authority comes from?
Yeah. I think that it's the extreme version of being a contrarian, of resisting authority, of saying they're telling us this, but we should question it. And that leads him to some feelings about everything from COVID lockdowns to mask mandates to lab leaks, and then sometimes even further in things that I would never go near, but he likes having these all sides turmoil.
You also write about his, you chronicle his political evolution.
Mm-hmm.
From somebody who supported Obama to somebody who didn't really like Donald Trump at the beginning of Donald Trump to somebody who now is questioning many of the things that questioning mask mandates, questioning lockdowns, is very in line with sort of a right-wing libertarian sort of red-pilled Silicon Valley crowd.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good description, which is not, people say he's become more conservative. He's become part of that sort of populist, maybe libertarian, somewhat right-wing questioning authority type.
He encouraged all his followers in 2022 to vote for Republicans. Do you think there's a chance that in 2024, in a Biden-Trump matchup, he would actually support Trump?
I don't think he likes Trump at all. He calls him a con man, reminds him of his father. I think that he feels pretty strongly that we should move to a new generation on both parties.
last question on AI. Earlier this year, Musk launches XAI, aiming to develop a maximum truth-seeking AI. Mm-hmm. He signed a letter previously encouraging us to slow down on AI and to not let it get ahead of us. Mm-hmm. You've discussed this with him at length. To what extent is Musk's concerns about AI and OpenAI and ChatGPT motivated by his altruistic sense, or is it also a self-serving sense that he wants his product and the AI that he's working on to have a competitive advantage?
I think ever since he was a kid, he worried after reading Isaac Asimov that the robots could get out of control, that AI mm-hmm. could be harmful rather than helpful to humanity. That's why he started and donated to, not as a business, OpenAI, which was a way to be a counterbalance to these closed artificial intelligence systems. He got quite upset when his partner in this philanthropic endeavor, Sam Altman, made OpenAI no longer open. So he called me and said, come, I want to explain to you, I'm going to start an AI endeavor. I don't think it's done to make a profit, because that's not a good way to make a profit right now, what he's doing. But he's trying to do things to connect us more closely to our computers, whether it be Neuralink, the chip that will allow computers and humans to communicate rapidly, or his other real-world AI systems like Optimus the Robot, where he puts a lot of security and safety and stop buttons and things that can't be overridden. I think that's what's driving him.
And in his properties between Twitter and Tesla and the others, he also now has the ability to collect vast amounts of data, mm-hmm. which will fuel his AI development. Mm-hmm. In the context of that data collection, do you trust that he'll use the data that he's accumulating responsibly?
I think that he will use both the video as well as the large language data to develop machines and neural networks that can reason, that can operate in the real world. I don't think, especially since he's not an advertising-driven company these days, I don't think he will violate privacy by saying, here's what you tweeted, therefore we're going to try to market to you. I think it's for this generative machine learning intelligence that he thinks we're going to need both for cars and robots and for other things in the real world.
How does he think about privacy?
He actually believes that if you're totally advertising driven, as Twitter was, you almost inherently got to invade people's privacy, or you've got to use their data to market to them. And so I think he wants more of a system of subscriptions, user gets to pay, which empowers the user more. And I don't think, compared to Meta or Facebook or Google, that there have been the same privacy concerns by regulators when it comes to Tesla or Twitter.
Last question. You write about Musk's conviction that the fate of civilization rests on his shoulders. He tells his employees at Tesla that if Tesla fails, the climate is doomed. If SpaceX fails, humanity will never become mm-hmm. multiplanetary. But you also say many of Musk's most laughable assertions also contain a kernel of truth. When you look back, when we look back, or when humanity looks back in 100 years, at Musk's legacy, do you think history will prove his sense of self-importance right?
Well, I think it's an epic sense of self-importance, and obviously inflated at times, but he does it almost half-jokingly. But when history looks back, it'll look at Ford and GM giving up on electric vehicles 15, 20 years ago, crushing the Chevy Bolt and deciding not to do it. It will look at NASA giving up on going to the moon, not being able to send astronauts into space. So if you say, which individual has done more to move us into the era of electric vehicles with solar roofs and battery packs, or move us into the era of space travel, he probably ranks probably number one in terms of individual having those impacts on history.
Walter Isaacson, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Margaret.